Welcome to Iconocast, the science and science advocacy podcast with your host, Dr. Greg Layden and Mike Hobrick. The new administration tried to silence federal scientists in ordering the official Twitter accounts not to tweet. The administration of the 45th president sent out signals they were going to control the scientific message by scrubbing the government websites of mention of climate change. They nominated a secretary of education who was promoted schools which place low priority on teaching evolution. And in the last two episodes of Iconocast, we have talked about science and philosophy as methods of inquiry that lead to better public policy decisions. The executive and the legislative branch of the current government seem very much vested in not using what scientists have discovered while deciding policy. There have been very clear directives that they intend to ignore science and service to energy goals, education, industrial regulation, and public health care. Canadian scientists have experience with a government that placed economic needs in front of the realities that scientists are discovering. In response to censorship and political control of the scientific message, the Death of Evidence March in Ottawa led to the formation of a science advocacy group, Evidence for Democracy. For this episode, our guest is Dr. Katie Gibbs. She's a biologist and the executive director of Evidence for Democracy. She will talk to us about the Canadian experience and what American scientists can do to keep science public in a hostile governmental environment. Katie Gibbs, would you like to tell us a little bit more about Evidence for Democracy and what the roots for your organization and what you do?
Sure. So Evidence for Democracy is a nonprofit organization in Canada that promotes the transparent use of evidence in government decision making. Quite a notion, right? We got started after a large science protest that happened in Canada. So under our last government, there were a lot of sort of anti-science policies. We saw things like government scientists being muzzled and not allowed to talk about their work to the public, drastic funding cuts for research, policy decisions that just completely went against all the available evidence. And so these things kind of built up and built up. And then finally, in early 2012, the government implemented what's called here is an omnibus bill. So basically in one bill, they were changing hundreds of pieces of legislation and cutting funding for a number of different research institutions. And one of the institutions that was losing its funding is called the Experimental Lakes Area. And this is a really unique facility where they've actually taken hundreds of small naturally occurring lakes, made them into a research facility so that scientists can actually do experiments on a whole lake to see what happens instead of doing it in a tank in a lab, which obviously is not really going to give you relevant results necessarily. So this is a world-renowned research station, and they had their funding completely cut. And so this was sort of like the last straw for the science community, and we were all very outraged. And I was completing my PhD at the time at the University of Ottawa. A number of us, the grad students and professors, decided that things had gotten bad enough that we needed to do something to show just how concerned the scientific community was about what was happening, you know, really to just show how bad it was. And so the idea for the Death of Evidence was born. And so we organized a mock funeral procession to commemorate the death of evidence, you know, a little bit of drama there. And we held this event, and we're expecting to get, you know, maybe a few hundred people is what we thought would be a success. And we ended up getting thousands of scientists.
This was all in Ottawa, or where was that?
This was in Ottawa in front of Parliament Hill here in our capital. And so we ended up getting thousands of scientists, and I mean, we were just absolutely blown away by the response. Incredible amount of national media, tons of international media, and the media continued for weeks and weeks after the event. And so we really sort of felt that we had, you know, struck a nerve with this event, and that there was so much momentum and interest that we needed to keep it going somehow. So many people had told me at the protest were almost entirely scientists who attended the event. And so many of them had told me that this was the first time they had ever done anything like this. This was their first time making protest signs, their first time participating in a march. And they were just so, so invigorated and empowered by this event that we knew we had to do something to keep it going. And that is why we decided to form a new organization, because there wasn't really anybody doing this kind of work in Canada. So that is how we decided to start Evidence for Democracy. And then it sort of modeled some different organizations that exist elsewhere. So, you know, in the U.S., you're lucky enough to have the Union of Concerned Scientists and especially their Center for Science and Democracy. We really have learned a lot from them. In the U.K., their Sense About Science. They do a lot of really great work, and there was really just a void in this kind of work in Canada. We do a lot of engagement with the scientific community, you know, offering training for them and making them better communicators, helping them figure out, you know, how they can be better advocates or even activists if that's what they want. We also do a lot around educating the public around the importance of science, and we do a lot of direct work with elected officials, you know, so almost sort of lobbying for science and evidence-based decision-making.
There were quite a few effects of the omnibus bill that, whether they were intended or not, it was a very dark time for federal scientists who wanted to be able to speak about their research. I was reading an article in the Smithsonian magazine about a shark researcher who had gotten a request for an interview, and he had no idea this was going to be a story. He knew that it was a shark that had come inland near Seattle, not even around Canada, and he had responded without getting clearance from the official party political boss who was supposed to give him clearance, and he went and had granted an interview, and he got into some trouble with that. And there was quite a bit of that kind of thing going on, wasn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it wasn't just muzzling around controversial issues. I mean, certainly we did see that, you know, things like climate change, especially any criticism of the oil sands, there was absolutely muzzling there. But that's what was so shocking, I think, to the scientific community, is that mundane, not at all controversial topics were censored as well. You know, I've heard about examples of muzzling on research on this type of algae called rock snot that is really just this like big disgusting looking piece of algae. You know, someone was doing, you know, just sort of a cute piece on snowflake patterns and was not able to talk to a scientist. Someone working on bison genes, and I think it was sort of, you know, how many genes overlap with modern domesticated cows, they were denied an interview. So it really was, you know, a change in the communication policy across the board that scientists were just not allowed to talk directly to journalists without getting approval from, you know, central communication staff. And this was very different from how things had been done up until that point. There had been many, many years where journalists just called up government scientists on the phone and were able to talk to them and do interviews. And then these policies came into place that were much more restrictive.
So I know that a lot of people are going to think back to when scientists didn't have to be political, when they're going to wonder, when they look at an organization like yours or the upcoming Science March, and they're going to ask questions about, well, why does science even need to be involved in politics? Why not just, you know, go back to your lab, do the research, we'll do the politics?
I think that's sort of been the strategy so far, and, you know, it hasn't exactly gotten us into a very good position. I also think science itself isn't political. You know, the facts aren't political, but I do think it's the job of scientists to stand up and defend science when it's under attack. It isn't, you know, it isn't necessarily a right or a left sort of issue. And certainly the right can attack science, but there are many, you know, pseudoscience issues happening within the sort of political left as well. And I think it's, in that sense, is why I don't really think it's a political issue. But I think as scientists, as the ones who understand just how important the principles of science are, you know, open communication of information, critical thinking, you know, rational thinking, we understand how important these things are and how important they are, not just for our own scientific pursuits, but for our society, for our democracy. We value that. And so it's up to us to defend these principles when they're under attack.
Can I jump in there for a second, too? Make a comment.
Yep.
Actually, Mike and I were actually talking about this earlier, and I've been asked that question so many times. Why are scientists suddenly getting involved in politics, and shouldn't they stay out of it and just wait for everything to settle down? And yeah, you're right. Science itself is not a political endeavor. But science has always been involved in politics in some way. For hundreds of years, astronomy was embroiled in controversy that had nothing to do with scientific controversy. Since the mid-19th century, the science of biology has been under attack by the church every single day. Sometimes it's more intense, sometimes it's less intense. But, you know, if you say to an evolutionary biologist, a scientist suddenly getting involved in politics, mm-hmm. they'll just laugh because it's it's been ever since I got interested in it. And there were other kids in my school that thought that I was going to go to hell because of that. Mm-hmm. And that's not, people may say, well, that's religion, it's not politics. I'm sorry. I'm talking about the whole thing. It really mm-hmm. is the whole thing. There's always been, physicists were involved in politics when they accidentally invented a method to destroy the entire planet.
And it's
always been there. But what hasn't happened is over the last several years since the 1960s, we have created a scientific community that is much larger than it ever was before. I got a job a while ago at the University of Minnesota where I had to be the guy in charge of hooking up undergraduates with scientists who were not in the same college. The university is divided into numerous colleges, and the biggest college doesn't have science. Mm-hmm. Okay. So then almost every student who wanted to get hooked up for a certain grant to a scientist, so we're talking about maybe 500 students a year, needed to hook up to a scientist outside of that college. And my job was to hook them up. So the first thing I did was I decided I'm going to make a database of all the scientists at the University of Minnesota. Mm-hmm. Do you know how many scientists there are at the University of Minnesota?
A lot.
100, 200, 300? No, it's thousands.
Yeah.
There are thousands of them. And you don't know the number because many are affiliated outside the university. Many of the scientists are working on a particular protein in a particular cell or a certain aspect of a magnetic thing or something about a certain chemical. Their science can't be politicized because nobody has a clue what it is. And what happened in Canada recently did, as you say, it politicized everything. And it suddenly became all science and everything was under attack. And that's obviously happening here where we're taking entire educational academic, you know, units of the government and just shutting them down or putting crazy people in charge of them. But basically what we have now since the 60s is we've created this really large number of highly specialized scientists who can get along just fine without ever having even knowing what the administrative structure of the institution that they work for looks like. Mm-hmm. They need to know nothing to do their science. And in some cases, they revel in it. And I think what we're seeing now in Canada, with what you're talking about, what we're seeing now with what's going on in this country right now, this week, next week, is all those scientists are suddenly realizing, wow, their entire career, everything they devote their lives to, is at stake. And to do something about it, they just have to show up in really large numbers. You know, suddenly, like you said, they're empowered and they're engaged. In a way, it's almost like a monster's been created here.
Yeah, and I think, too, as part of the reason why they should engage is I always feel like I have to remind scientists that they're citizens as well. I don't understand where this idea came in that, you know, scientists are somehow, like, outside of the rest of society and they're just supposed to, you know, sit and watch and be impartial and be unbiased. And I think that's absolutely ridiculous. You know, first of all, they are citizens as well. So, you know, from that perspective, I think they have a responsibility to engage and can't just sort of sit it out. And I think too, you know, you were talking about how there's almost been sort of like a change in that sentiment about whether or not to sort of get political and get engaged. And I know what I've seen here is there's a bit of a generational difference. It was definitely sort of the older school mentality that you just did your science and you put your head down and you didn't engage in politics or policy or advocacy or any of that kind of thing. You know, the sort of younger generation of scientists, that is not their feeling at all. You know, they have a deep desire to do more than just do their science. They want to communicate it. They want to get out there and integrate science with the public. They want to influence policy. And so I think that's why we're seeing these new movements happening. And another reason, sort of lastly, is I think scientists learned a lot from the climate change debates and what was the result of that? Do you think that at first climate scientists absolutely took the mentality of don't engage with the deniers, the science will win out in the end? We just keep doing rigorous science and putting it out there and putting out our consensus statements. You know, truth will win in the end was very much what people thought. And that didn't happen. You know, there were huge misinformation campaigns that were very successful, and that didn't happen. And so I think now, after seeing that, you know, what has happened with that issue, I think that's also why scientists are realizing that just putting out good science is no longer enough.
Well, the goal of the Harper government, they were mostly trying to get Canada to be moved to the forefront of the oil industry in the world. And they had to kind of suppress the idea that climate change really could be a problem for Canada. And so it stretched into areas where, like, they were suppressing research on polar bear habitats. Suddenly, I imagine the loneliest research stations up north of Churchill were all of a sudden feeling the big hand of the government coming in and taking away their, you know, their livelihoods.
Well, absolutely. But, you know, again, that's part of what was so, so incredible about what was happening in Canada is that it wasn't even just, you know, environmental climate change issues. You know, look at, our census. You know, our long form census was eliminated, which is like the backbone of informed public policy at every level of government. You know, businesses use that data, schools use that data, hospitals use that data. You know, it was an invaluable data set, and they canceled it. So it's hard to even know, you know, fully what was the reasoning behind this. I think a lot of it just came down to, you know, they had a mandate that they wanted to implement, which absolutely part of that mandate was, you know, expansion of the oil sands. They were not, you know, shy about that, but they had a broader mandate as well. And they just felt that any science or research or data or evidence could potentially get in the way of them implementing their mandate. And same thing with the scientists being allowed to speak to the public. You know, it was just easier for them to stop all communication. And it was easier for them to just, you know, cut data programs, you know, stop creating new data sets and surveys. It just sort of helped prevent, you know, pesky facts from getting in the way of the policies that they wanted to implement.
One of the things that some of the scientists in the United States are now talking about is the drive to get scientists elected to office. Some of them are starting at the congressional level, and I have personal disagreement with that. I think that's starting way too high up. It's like trying to run before you learn how to walk. I think they should do it locally. But I'm kind of wondering if your organization has been seeing scientists now that they've been more active in government, and have you seen any scientists that have started either running for like the provincial government or for the parliament to be MPs?
Well, I think it's definitely something I would like to see more of. I've been following that initiative in the U.S., and I think it's a great idea. You know, I think it's sort of the longer term strategy, right? But I think that ultimately having more scientists and people with science backgrounds in elected office, you know, is a huge positive step forward. I don't really think we've seen, you know, a huge shift in that here. You know, very much the scientists that I know are still quite hesitant to get involved in political politics. But that said, we do have one that comes to mind who actually is a climate scientist, and he ran at the provincial level and was elected. That's at least one really good example of a scientist running for office and winning, which is even better.
Yeah, he was also involved in a lawsuit that roughly paralleled the one with Mike Mann in the National Review.
Yes, won that absolutely. As well. Yeah, it was Andrew Weaver.
Mm-hmm. And what province is he in, Ontario?
No, British Columbia.
British Columbia. Do you have any advice now? We're going to have a March for Science coming up on Earth Day in the United States, and there's going to be several sister marches, including here where I am in Phoenix. I imagine there's going to be one in Minneapolis, too.
And here in Ottawa, we're organizing a bunch of solidarity marches as well.
Yeah, they're all over the world.
Yeah.
Friend that's from the Philippines, and she had said that the marches, the weekend of the inauguration, was an inspiration to people all over the world, and including in Phoenix. And if we had not done something in response to the election, then it would have been really disheartening and discouraging to people in other countries. To see Canada and in Europe, in other countries, join us in these kinds of things, these protests against this, I think it's kind of exciting to see people are kind of resisting what we thought was going to be a trend towards nationalism. But as far as follow-up goes, with your experience, now that you've got a more science-friendly government, what kind of things, after the march, people who organize these things, what can we do to keep it rolling?
Well, I think first, you know, I just want to do say how important I think the march is. And, you know, I've already seen some articles saying, is this a good idea? Is it going to just politicize science further? You know, they're questioning whether or not it's going to actually lead to anything. The best example, the only sort of other related data point that we have, is the Death of Evidence rally that happened in Canada. I do absolutely think that the rally itself and the movement that it started and the momentum that we maintained absolutely led to concrete improvements for science in Canada. So, you know, we did elect a much more science-friendly government in 2015, and, you know, to the surprise of, I think, everyone who was following the election, science was actually a really big election issue here. Mm-hmm. And that has never happened before. And I would hear candidates who were running saying how they were so surprised that literally when they were going door to door, knocking on people's doors, people were saying, you know, one of the issues that they were hearing again and again at the door was people asking about the muzzling of scientists and what they were going to do to stop that. So, you know, it really did become sort of a household issue and an issue that politicians really cared about and talked about during the election. So, you know, I think first I want to just encourage people to show up at the marches. I do think that they're important. They show, you know, how much interest and momentum there is in this issue. But you're right, the follow-up is key. You know, I think you're lucky in the States to have so many different organizations that kind of already exist to help support this new movement. And I know the March for Science organizers right now are kind of trying to figure out exactly what comes next. But, you know, really it is just about keeping the interest and energy going. And I think a big part of that should be focused on training. You know, the scientists who are interested, that's great. But, you know, if you have people who up until this point have just been, you know, keeping their head down in their microscope, and now they want to engage more, they probably could use some training and help figuring out how best to do that. So, you know, communications training, advocacy training, the training, you know, sort of how to run for office training, mm-hmm. that is being provided. So, you know, I think it's really about training, and, you know, there's going to have to be more opportunities for actions like the march to keep the momentum going as well.
I like to remind people that Rosa Parks was not just some young lady who wouldn't move her seat. She was a professional activist and part of a professional organization. And your point is really important. You can't just say, I want to go to a march, or I'm really mad about this, I'm going to write somebody a letter. You can do that, but the thing that I hear most often from people who get involved is, well, it didn't really succeed, but at least we raised awareness. And, you know, I just want to sit that person down and explain raising awareness is something that's really important, but this issue is something that everybody knows about. And all raising awareness does is increase the degree to which people are inured to it. You have to actually have activism that is professional, that has goals, that has ways that the goals can be achieved and measured, and so on. And you're absolutely right. This training is important. Mm-hmm. Just like doing science isn't something. The negative response that happened to the science march that I saw initially was actually partly correct. Think about academics more broadly, not just scientists, but academics more broadly. They have two problems. One is because they have been told how smart they are for their entire lives, they think that they're really, really smart and can do anything, some of them. And because they've been focused on this one really important thing for their entire lives, they actually can't do anything. You know, and it's very easy for people to just assume that this other thing people are doing is just a hobby, or it's just an avocation, or it's easy to do. That's not what's happening. The March for Science here is being professionalized, and they're going to do a good job. And people do have to get involved, and they have to get training, and they have to be persistent. We can't have a lot of action in a few weeks and then kind of walk away.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be maintained. And it's very fortunate in Canada and the United States right now that the summer is coming. All these early marches are happening in crappy weather. It's only going to get better.
Yeah.
It's only going to get better. And you know, we saw that happen with the Occupy movement. In the Occupy movement, one bad winter, and then they kind of went into the next summer and petered out. And they basically eschewed professional organization. They didn't think that it was important to them. And that's why we don't really see them anymore. We don't hear about them anymore. The subunit of the Occupy movement that was professionally organized ultimately became the Bernie Sanders run, really, through a couple of stages. And that was a real live political thing that had power, and it was important, and it was well done. Everybody has to keep that in mind. They have to keep this professionalized, and they have to keep it moving.
Well, and I like your analogy with science. Like, so what I often remind people is that I always think of it as sort of like a teeter-totter. Like, social change is a teeter-totter where, you know, every action, every protest, you know, every petition is sort of like getting you one step closer. And at the time, you're never sure which is the action that is going to tip it to the other side. The Rosa Parks example is a great one. You know, there were so many other actions taking place before that, and you never know which one is going to be, you know, the iconic one that is the tipping point. And it's the same thing with science, right? It's not like one study doesn't change things. It's a huge, you know, accumulation of things. And then, you know, eventually one study might have a big breakthrough, but it's because of all the studies that came before it. And so I think it's important to keep that in mind. It's taking you one step closer, and you're never sure, you know, which of those steps is going to be the big one.
What do you see for the future now for Evidence for Democracy? What's going to happen next, do you think? You've got a fairly friendly government, but what if, pendulum swinging, what if we get a conservative government back in power? Do you think that you have enough of a groundwork laid that you'll be able to protect the freedom of science?
Well, so one of the things we're working on, I mean, in general, what we're trying to do is sort of get as many sort of safeguards put in place that will be there regardless of the government. You know, things that make it harder for future governments to undermine science. And so, you know, one example of this, we had a really good win. We've been working a lot with the union that represents government scientists here, and they have actually been pushing and succeeded in getting this sort of right to speak included in their union contract. And so that's huge. You know, here a union contract is sort of even more ironclad than a piece of legislation.
Oh, Canadian unions are fierce entities.
Yes. So this is huge. You know, a future government can undo legislation easily if they have a majority in parliament, whereas going back and taking out things from a public sector union, no, that's not going to happen. I think this is the first time, at least, that I've heard of this kind of thing happening anywhere in the world, of getting this right to speak in the union for government scientists. So that's been a huge win. We're also still putting pressure on our government to create science integrity policies, mm-hmm. Similar to what Obama put in the U.S. So we're still sort of putting some pressure on them on that. You know, we want to actually, just saying that things are great isn't enough. We want them to actually go the next step and put these policies into place. I think scientists here had been feeling quite confident and, you know, okay, things are done. You know, we can just go back to our science. We don't have to organize anymore. But I think, you know, what's been happening in the U.S. has struck a nerve here as well. I think people now are starting to get more engaged again and sort of asking that question of, you know, what happens if something similar happens here in the future? You know, we need to start organizing now to be prepared and to ideally, you know, stop a government that anti-science from even, you know, getting elected here in the first place, so that we don't even have to worry about organizing against them.
All right, and that website is evidencefordemocracy.ca. Invite everybody all over the world that listens to Iconocast, go to that site, and there's some great graphics on here, some good articles, and really take some inspiration for what we need to have here in the States over the next 4 years to keep science protected.
2 years.
2 years, when we get a better Congress. You're right.
And then we...
All right. Well, thank you, Katie.
Yeah, thank you for having me on. It was a great discussion.
Thank you for listening and downloading this episode of Iconocast with Katie Gibbs. Go to evidencefordemocracy.ca and read up on the work they have done, and then follow up with the March for Science. If you can't make it to Washington, there will be a local march in your area. Oh, and write to the media to demand that science be given due respect in their coverage. That's why we make this podcast, to advocate for science.